This is episode 2 of the pod. If you haven't yet listened to episode 1, check that out first. We'll meet you back here. Larry Gumberg's office is in an elegant old skyscraper in downtown Pittsburgh. I took the elevator to the 9th floor every few weeks to talk with him. 9th floor. Larry called one of our conversations math class. We sat in his conference room.
Let's say we have a project. Today the taxes are $100,000 a year, and after the development they're going to be $200,000 a year.
Larry drew out an imaginary development on a yellow legal pad. He roughed out all the costs, how the bills get paid. It quickly became clear to me that making this all work is very complicated.
I'm willing to put the time and effort into the work. I'd like to say that we don't really do anything hard. We're just willing to do it.
Larry's been in the development business a long time. It is always a calculated risk. There's no guarantee that anything will work. You just try to anticipate everything that can go wrong and then prepare to adapt. On a construction site a few months later, he put it this way.
You know, as a developer, you really have to be an optimist.
From 90.5 WESA, this is Land and Power. Who has it, what they do with it, and how that shapes the cities around us. I'm Margaret J. Krause. I heard about the owners of Penn Plaza for years before I ever met Larry and his sons, Brian and Zach. A lot of what I heard sounded like this.
They believe that Pittsburgh is a commodity to be bought and sold and bartered to make a profit.
To approve of this opportunistic flip communicates that you agree with the Gumbergs' brutal message. We have better, whiter, richer things in mind.
Because you don't give a damn about the future of this community. All you care about is lining your pockets.
People seemed to accept that Larry Gumberg was this heartless guy who didn't care about the residents of Penn Plaza or Pittsburgh or its future. That was the only widely available storyline. Larry and Brian and Zach didn't do much to challenge it. Sometimes news stories would have a statement from Larry, or more often a quote from his lawyer. You know, what benefits the planned development might deliver. But nothing personal. No rebuttal or explanation of why they did what they did. For a long time, I thought of Larry simply as the developer, more of an archetype than a person. Today, how did Larry Gumberg come to be viewed as a symbol for everything wrong with Pittsburgh's resurgence and not see it coming? Turns out, the story everyone knows misses a lot. On a morning in early June, I asked to meet Larry in his natural habitat, a development site.
How are you?
Hello, how are you?
In a hard hat and practical shoes, Larry crunched happily across the dirt. He seemed completely at ease.
It's not like I can stand here all day long and watch construction, although I would if I could, because I love it.
Some kids grow up in families where there are multiple generations of teachers or firefighters or doctors. Larry comes from multiple generations of Pittsburgh developers. Starting in the 1920s, Larry's grandfather helped Sears Roebuck set up stores. After World War II, Larry's dad helped the city's manufacturers grow. He bought and sold land and warehouses. In the 1960s, when the retail economy and the babies were booming, the Gumbergs moved into apartments and shopping plazas. When you Google Larry Gumberg, one of the first hits is a black and white photo from his company's website. It's a grand opening, a ribbon cutting from the 1960s. The men in the photo sport thick glasses, the boys are in skinny ties, and the girls are in Peter Pan collars. Larry's grandfather is there, so are his dad and his brothers. They're all arrayed along the ribbon, caught in that pre-photo chaos when everyone's trying to get into place. Larry's in the middle. He's the only kid looking at the camera, his scissors on the ribbon. Larry admired his father and grandfather. They took their work very seriously, and he did too. But he did not see himself following in their footsteps.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
A farmer.
Really?
Like a lot of kids, Larry loved horses. He liked the idea of caring for land and for animals. It wasn't just a kind of idle fantasy. He earned his degree from Penn State University's agriculture school. But it was always sort of understood that he would eventually join the family business.
Farmers are extraordinary risk takers. It's not that big of a leap to go from farming to development, where it is a similar kind of a
risk tolerance.
Larry started to learn the ins and outs of development after college. How to pitch a bank on an idea. How to build relationships with merchants or residents. Like his grandfather and his dad, he learned to keep an eye on the world around him, ready to respond to changes in the market. He wasn't prepared for the world to collapse. Making stuff accounted for nearly half of all U.S. jobs in the 1950s. But over the next couple decades, manufacturing absorbed blow after blow.
Tonight, what is an industrial policy, and is it the cure for America's economic ills?
Already tough times are about to get tougher.
In the early 1980s, it finally succumbed.
The U.S. Steel Corporation announced today that it will close all or part of more than 20 of its plants.
Strikers don't qualify for unemployment benefits, but locked-out workers do. That income will be critical for many.
It's just lose one thing after the other. Next, it'll be your home, your cars. Who knows? Maybe your life.
The collapse took out cities all over the country, from Birmingham, Alabama, to Detroit, from Milwaukee to Camden. In what must have felt like a split second, cities and the people who lived in them went from prosperous and important to hollowed out. In Pittsburgh, unemployment hit almost 20%, and home foreclosures soared. In 1984, the suicide rate in the region was double the national rate. For a lot of people, especially younger people, the only good option was to leave. Between 1970 and 1990, the Pittsburgh region lost more than 250,000 people. They took their tax dollars with them. They took their children and their children's children with them. Larry stayed.
You have to believe that the world will grow up around you.
All over the region, there were suddenly a lot of empty, idle buildings and boarded up windows. All up and down East Liberty, too. Walking past those blank storefronts felt eerie. This constant reminder of how life used to be. Larry had watched his father and grandfather shape Pittsburgh. Part of his work became trying to salvage it.
We were taking projects that were broken or distressed in one way or another and fixing them and selling them.
There was still this nagging existential dread. What is the city gonna do? It was a question shared by just about everyone in Pittsburgh. The answer, fundamentally, was attract new people. Some people still hoped steel and manufacturing would come back. But by the 1990s, there was a strategy afoot to transform the trappings of the old Pittsburgh to build a new one. It was all about shifting perspective. Those old row houses? Starter homes! That rusted steel mill? Industrial chic! A vacant Sears building in East Liberty? Now it's a bustling home improvement store. This is one of the great municipal hustles of all time. By 1996, nearly $400 million of investment was flowing into Pittsburgh, reshaping the landscape. We'll get into how this worked in the next episode, but for now, it worked. The comeback helped forge one of Larry's fundamental beliefs. Development can turn a place around. He could see it working. National chains were claiming space in and around East Liberty.
And next thing you know, you've got a large population of people who are going to that area. Then comes the apartment activity that follows, and then comes the office activity that follows, and then comes the restaurant activity that follows.
Around 2010, Larry started thinking about what role his land was going to play in East Liberty. A community plan had described Penn Plaza as a complex that, quote, while not physically deteriorated, continues to give the area the image of a public project.
I'm Maylene Myers.
Maylene Myers ushered that plan into existence. Maylene directs East Liberty's Community Development Corporation, called East Liberty Development Incorporated. She started in 1996, when the neighborhood was trying to figure out how to rebound from the 80s and early 90s.
And I think really what seems for me devastating, that there wasn't anyone here. It was so quiet. The streets were quiet. You walk out, there was nothing going on.
Before ELDI released the first community plan, they held meetings for 3 years. Maylene would stand up front and ask, what do you want to see here? Over and over, she heard people talk about the good old days, when East Liberty was one of the state's best-known shopping districts.
I remember nice stores and, you know, beautiful department stores. You know, I remember my mother dressing up. You know, you sat in restaurants, you went to Isley, you had your fountain drinks, you know, and then you go your shopping.
The notes from those meetings fill a 6-inch binder. Maylene still keeps it in her office. She calls it my Bible. She says the vision was clear, and the question became, where do we begin?
You want to see, what should the focus be on. And the focus was, we need to turn this around to make it a place to come, a destination again.
To make East Liberty a destination, the plan imagined new housing that would replace Penn Plaza and the other old 1960s apartment towers on those big super blocks of land. East Liberty would have a proper main street again, and jobs. People would spend time and money in the neighborhood. Larry got the message loud and clear. As the vision for East Liberty began to materialize, he started to dream big about a new development at Penn Plaza.
How can we do something that fits in? How can we do something that is special for the community? And what might be transformative for purposes of creating a bigger and better environment for all?
Larry spent his early career managing decline. And now, like his city, he had a chance to build something instead. Around that time, Larry's two sons brought up the idea of moving back to Pittsburgh.
It's really a an emotional subject for me.
Like basically every parent ever, Larry wanted his kids to live close by, but he didn't think Pittsburgh could offer them the real estate education they could get in New York, where first Brian and then Zach moved after college. They had good jobs, even despite the global financial crisis.
I really didn't want them to leave their positions that they had. They were just learning so many things that I couldn't begin to teach them.
Brian and Zach have a different development metabolism than their dad. Not that Larry hasn't worked on difficult and complex projects, but Larry came of age in the business in a cratered Pittsburgh economy, while Brian and Zach cut their teeth in New York City. Even during the Great Recession, that place was, and is, like the WWE cage match of development. They both worked for publicly traded companies. Zach's company competed directly with Brian's company at one point.
It was the big leagues, you know, like back here, I don't want to say it's not the big leagues, but this was the big leagues. And
Brian remembers being 21 and working until 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning.
The first deal I ever did was $251 million acquisition of a building in Times Square, New York, where we wrote a check, cash check for it.
What did Pittsburgh have that Philly and New York didn't?
An existing family business.
Still, to go from the nation's financial center to Pittsburgh was a bit of an adjustment. That first year, both Brian and Zach also lived at home with their parents.
That took a lot of patience. I ended up at the casino and the gym more often than I probably should have.
The city they moved back to was not the one they left in the early 2000s. People seemed to discover that the pace of life in Pittsburgh was nice. It had all the city stuff, parks, museums, and restaurants, but at half the price of most other places. People saw opportunity here. They started things, theater companies and breweries. There were volunteer fairs and urban hiking tours. Brian and Zach and Larry were starting something too. A few years earlier, Larry broke away from the family firm he grew up in to build a new one. The boys came home to help. Brian says it took a while to realize they weren't working for someone else anymore. They were working for themselves.
And so the thought process isn't different from you want to do the right thing, but it's different from a long-term perspective. You know, the decision that you make today is going to impact your life 10 years from now, whereas in New York, the decision that I make today, someone else is going to deal with it 10 years from now.
They were learning a new business, building relationships with mom-and-pop tenants alongside national chains. Penn Plaza was a kind of outlier in the firm's portfolio. The family business used to manage thousands of apartments, but the 80s changed that. It'd become almost all commercial real estate. Zach says it was a few years before they started thinking about ways to grow the business.
And, you know, that's when we started assessing Penn Plaza and thinking about what are the long-term, you know, implications here.
From Brian and Zach's perspective, the long-term implications were not looking good. Zach says the apartment complexes built in the 1960s, Penn Plaza included, had a lot of challenges.
The buildings were built with the best of intentions, but they weren't built to today's standards. There was no insulation in the buildings. It was single-pane windows.
They say the heating bill for Penn Plaza was more than the rent that came in each month. Brian says they were losing money every year just operating the complex. He says a massive renovation was a possibility, but it would have cost millions of dollars.
That same person that was renting an apartment for $400, just to make the numbers break even, might be $1,700.
In development, the numbers have to work. Ultimately, Larry and Brian and Zach decided demolition and redevelopment was the better option. It was exciting. It was this big, new, ground-up project they got to take on all together. They took their cue from New York and other cities they'd worked in, like D.C. and Miami and Atlanta.
they all have these great mixed-use developments where people want to flock to, and they want to live, and they want to eat, and they want to shop, and it's diverse. You know, our small piece of the world, our 7 acres that we've had over there, we thought it was a good start.
Let's take a short break. We'll be right back.
Americans are grappling with a huge question right now. Can we trust the cops?
These are the different reasons people were put on the list. Falsifying reports or records.
What if I told you that in states all across the country,
issuance of unlawful orders,
there are lists that could tell you if individual cops were trustworthy.
Obedience to laws and policies.
These lists can draw a straight line from an officer's name to past misconduct. The problem is, there's a good chance you're not allowed to see them.
To turn a blind eye is basically saying, well, I hope the justice system works. That's not good enough for me.
I'm Jason Moon. From New Hampshire Public Radio, Document, Season 1, The List, a podcast about one state's decades of secrecy around police misconduct. Binge all the episodes now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Once the Gumbergs agreed that redeveloping Penn Plaza was the way to go, they started planning. They decided they were going to slowly ask people to move out over the course of a year.
And all of a sudden, an article comes out in the newspaper that we were throwing all the tenants out of the building.
You can kind of hear it in Larry's voice, still, 5 years later. This July 2015 newspaper article really bothers Larry, because he says it's just incorrect. Yes, as part of their plan to gradually close down Penn Plaza, some tenants got a letter in the summer of 2015.
That their lease was going to expire in 30 days and that we were not going to be able to renew it.
Larry wasn't required by law to give more than a month's notice, but it didn't seem like enough time to him.
So how about if you try to get out in 90 days?
The fact that it was some tenants and not everybody at Penn Plaza is a really important point for Larry, because Larry thought he was doing the right thing. He wanted to be respectful of the tenants. He didn't want some 200 people looking for apartments all at once. But that's not how the people who lived there saw it. Neither did people like Kevin Acklin. In the summer of 2015, Kevin Acklin was chief of staff to Pittsburgh's mayor Bill Peduto. Kevin was also the city's chief development officer. He sat down with Larry to pass along the mayor's message. We don't do business this way.
Again, the fact that there was going to be development at the Penn Plaza location, not a bad thing. I mean, perhaps. The way it happened is what's bad. People were afraid that they were going to be thrown on the streets. I think that is a mass eviction.
But Brian says eviction is a legal process. It has a specific set of legal consequences that usually mean it's harder for people to get approved for an apartment.
We just said that we're not renewing your lease. That is not an eviction. That is the right of a private property owner to say that we've got different plans for the unit.
This is the basic truth of private property rights. You own it. You get to decide what to do. But by 2015, the city's eagerness for development, any development, had shifted a little. People were beginning to question the value of just building something to generate tax money and construction jobs. They were beginning to ask, what can your development do for the environment? What can it do for neighborhood businesses? What can it do for people? The mayor and his staff led that charge. Penn Plaza became the place to live these ideals, to prove that Pittsburgh could do more, could do better. The way Larry saw it, the city was putting roadblocks in the way that would discourage new business from coming to Pittsburgh. But he never thought his project would create a firestorm.
What was the first time that you heard that people were upset?
Well, we actually heard about it when we read the newspaper, that people were upset.
He didn't know about the heart problems, the frantic search for a new place on lunch breaks. He didn't know people were calling their kids out of state, terrified by the prospect of meeting a 90-day deadline. He didn't know. I know what you're thinking. How could Larry and Brian and Zach not know that this was going to be a big deal? Larry had watched Pittsburgh attract investment and development again. He saw busy streets and new coffee shops and condos carved into old factories, all of which made it possible to think about doing a new development at Penn Plaza. But what he saw was the business environment. The idea that people would have a hard time finding an apartment in their budget? That Pittsburgh had an affordable housing crisis? Larry saw affordable housing as the government's responsibility. And Zach says it wasn't even on his radar.
There was no talk about affordable housing crisis in Pittsburgh. There was no talk about it. I mean, all of a sudden we go to not renew some leases, and the next thing you know, we're somehow the poster, you know, child for this crisis. And it's like, wait a minute, I thought we were the most affordable city in the country.
Pittsburgh had changed in a way they didn't see. And Larry wasn't alone. A lot of people didn't see it. But that blind spot set the narrative in stone. Larry Gumberg, villain. Larry thinks of himself as a fundamentally good person. His family ingrained in him early on that he had an obligation to serve Pittsburgh.
How was it modeled for you? How did you perceive it, I guess?
Well, it was very direct.
His parents were involved. They sat on the boards of nonprofits and went to fundraisers.
You go to the cancer dinner, you go to the symphony gala. There's a social life that comes with that. There is a cultural life that comes with that. And there is a eleemosynary activity that makes it a genuinely rewarding experience.
A what activity?
Eleemosynary.
You want to, for those of us.
All right, let me see if I can Wikipedia the exact eleemosynary. How do you spell it? Relating to or dependent on charity, charitable. It's compassion. It's participating to compassionate activities. Yes.
And so, why is that important?
I'd like to think that when I look back on my life, that there are things that I can point to say, I did that, I helped there, I participated, I made my life worthwhile, not just for myself, but for others.
Larry volunteers his time to hospitals and universities. He and his family donate every year to community organizations. Then he woke up one day in July of 2015 and found out he was a heartless, unthinking person. He was upset, angry, but he figured, just take it on the chin.
You know, sticks and stones. Okay. I write it off to that.
And then an unlikely meeting with a local pastor shifted how Larry saw the whole thing. Rodman Street Missionary Baptist Church is just a few blocks away from Penn Plaza. On a Tuesday night last February, Reverend Daryl Kennedy listened to the choir rehearse. He was sitting in this sanctuary as part of his job interview 11 years before when God spoke to him.
I believe that the vestiges of what has gone on in Pittsburgh with African Americans in particular, that God sent me here to make a difference.
Daryl approaches life with a vigor that's palpable. He has plans and a plan to realize the plans. He absorbed that idea of purpose and focus at Morehouse College in Atlanta.
Our most famous graduate is Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
At Morehouse, he heard the same credo over and over again.
For unto whom much is given, much is required. It's Luke 12:48. But I heard those words so much, for unto whom much is given, much is required, that it became who I am. I am a nonviolent activist, but I am an activist.
In 2015, Daryl was working on an energetic new mission to expand what the church could be for its parishioners and for the community. He needed more space, a lot more space. He found the perfect spot, but he could never seem to get in touch with the guy who owned it.
It was Larry Gumberg.
He kept trying to get a meeting.
And I was really put off initially because I felt like they wouldn't even give me an opportunity to even meet me. So I felt that that was some racism and some other things, some social class or what have you. And I said, at least meet me.
Someone else bought Daryl's dream property. He says it's okay, he found another. But he still hadn't met this guy, Larry Gumberg. He wanted to meet him. He kicked the matter upstairs.
I went to his website and I saw a picture of him and I started praying. And I said, God, help me to meet this man. so that he can at least see who I am and what I'm about.
One Saturday, Daryl left the church to run some errands and headed for the bank. Just as he pulled into the parking deck, he stopped for a man crossing the street and also heading for the bank. That looks like Larry Gumberg, he thought.
And I went and got in the line, and he came up right behind me. And I turned around and I said, "Are you Lawrence Gumberg?" He said, "Yes! Good to see you again." I said, "You don't know me."
He says to me, "I'm Daryl Kennedy," and I said, "Hello. Do I know you?" And he said, "No, you don't know me, but..."
He and I spent 10 minutes in the conference room of the bank that we didn't ask anybody that we can go in. From that day to this day, Larry Gumberg has become a confidant of mine, a friend of mine, a helper of mine.
About a week after they first met, Daryl saw the same newspaper article Larry did, the one that said he was evicting a bunch of people from an apartment building called Penn Plaza.
And I said, "Lawrence Gumberg, that's the guy." And so I called him and said, "Hey, man, I read about what they, you know, what they're saying about you in the paper. You know, I said, I want to help you."
Daryl Kennedy seems like the last person to offer help and empathy to Larry Gumberg in 2015. What about Larry made Daryl pick up the phone after one chance meeting at the bank?
When I read about it, the spin that the newspaper, the media, to say that, you know, this man is displacing people, I wanted to find out myself. I wanted to learn who he was. And once I sat with him, once I learned more about him, I think he regrets how it happened.
Daryl felt like Larry didn't know what to do.
This is what I do. You know, I'm in the community. I want to help my people. And so I just saw it as an opportunity. Okay, what can I do to try to bridge this gap?
This gap between who Larry thinks he is and who other people think Larry is. No one wants to be told they're a bad person. No one likes to feel misunderstood. Here are all these people saying all Larry cares about is money, and he's like, "No, I care about this community." And then out of the blue, a man you barely know says, "I see you. This looks really hard. I want to help."
Dr. Kennedy has graciously been by my side to help me understand a lot of the turmoil that we were going through back then.
Daryl helped Larry see what the people at Penn Plaza and in Pittsburgh might be feeling, about how the neighborhood had changed, and how some people didn't feel like it was for them anymore.
Sometimes when you live in a certain stratosphere, you don't understand other people who don't live in that stratosphere. So what I've been able to do now is to let him see a different side. I've been poor. I've been on the underside.
While Larry and Daryl were getting to know each other that summer, Larry was in talks with the city about Penn Plaza. The talks were led by Kevin Acklin, the mayor's chief of staff. Larry didn't have to negotiate. He owned Penn Plaza, and he could tear it down if he wanted to. But he decided to negotiate. And in a way, Daryl was part of those negotiations.
Did he affect how you thought about those initial negotiations, those initial conversations at all, about affordable housing, about how the community was changing or felt about change?
Oh, he surely did. Like any kind of education, when you have better understanding, you have a better result.
He was like, "I think Larry regrets how it happened and is trying to make the best thing happen moving forward." Do you feel like that's fair?
Let's not rehash activities that are water over the dam.
He was saying, hold on.
I've got some. I just have a few more minutes here.
Okay.
We talked for almost half an hour longer. This happened a few times in my conversations with Larry. I'd ask him about a detail of Penn Plaza, and he would redirect or pivot.
"We are in the business of moving forward with positive optimism."
Or ask me to stop recording. You're motioning for me to cut off the tape. There are parts of this story Larry does not want to revisit. I don't think it's because he doesn't want to talk about it, because we talked about Penn Plaza for months, and about development, and how development can be a positive force for change. He just isn't convinced that telling this story again will do any good. Larry decided a long time ago he'd have to ignore what people say about him, even though he came to agree with a lot of what the city and the residents and the activists were saying.
That affordable housing needs to occur, that that the people that live in the community need to be able to stay in the community. We agree with that, and we're doing something about it.
Next time on Land and Power, Larry Gumberg, Bob Jamieson, Gail Williams, and the city of Pittsburgh spend a long, hot summer negotiating the future of Penn Plaza. The showdown was nearly a century in the making. Land and Power is a production of 90.5 WESA, reported and hosted by me, Margaret J. Krause. The show was edited and produced by Liz Reed. Production help from Katie Blackley, Kylie Kaczynski, and Sarah Kovash. Fact-checking by Sonu Babu, Patrick Doyle, Mary Rose O'Donnell, Isabel Schmeller, and Naomi Starobin. Special thanks to NPR's Story Lab team, including Uri Berliner, Nigeri Eaton, Adelina Lansianis, Michael May, and Yowei Shaw. Thanks also goes to David Boylan, Kate Giamarisi, Brian Izett, and John Miller. Larkin Page Jacobs, Lucy Perkins, Chris Potter, Ellis Robinson, Skip Schwab, and Mary Lee Williams. We've got photos of Larry, Daryl, Kevin, Penn Plaza, East Liberty, and more at landandpowerpod.com.